Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the Jataka tales. And the Jataka tales, a lot of you will have heard of, but some people might not have come across them at all. They're slightly different from a lot of the suttas that we've heard about already in the Pali Canon. They're actually probably the most well-known texts in the Far East, in Buddhist societies in the Far East. And certainly, they're probably amongst the most popular of the suttas in traditional Buddhist societies in the Far East. But they're not talked about or taught very much in the West for reasons that might become obvious, but we'll talk about later. So I'm going to tell you a bit about them. I'm going to explain to you why Westerners tend not to take that much notice of them, but to show why they're really quite important and why they've got quite a lot to tell us about the Buddhist path. So, what the Jatakas are to begin with. If you've heard stories about the Buddha's enlightenment, then you've probably heard that one of the things that happened to him in the process of his enlightenment is that he suddenly began to see his previous lives. He suddenly began to remember his previous lives. And the story goes that in the course of the night on which he became enlightened, he remembered life after life after life after life that he'd lived in the past, and all the things that happened to him during those lives. And that there were all sorts of things that he remembered about those past lives. Well, the Jatakas are traditionally the stories of the Buddha's past lives. So traditionally, they are believed to be the stories of Buddha's past lives. There's an awful lot of them. There's a book called the Jataka Tales, which has 457 tales in it. And then there's a whole lot of other Jataka tales that are kind of sprinkled through the Pali Canon. There's a set of 24 which are meant to be the lives of the Buddha, of Gautama, of our Buddha, as it were, when he met previous Buddhas. So there are stories that he'd been around for so long that actually he'd met Buddhas of previous eras, Buddhas of the past. And then there's a whole lot of suttas in which the Buddha just kind of comes up with some remembrance about previous lives. So there's a whole lot of Jataka tales. There's probably 600 or more altogether. And if you open them up and have a look at them, what you'll find is something that looks a bit like a collection of folk tales. So they're often witty. They're full of colourful characters. There are clever monkeys, there are wise elephants, there are brave princes, there are good and wicked kings, there are holy men of many assorted, there are many assorted holy men, and there are tree spirits, there are all sorts of beings. And actually during these many, many lives of the previous Buddha, he lived not only as a human being, he lived as many different sorts of animals and birds. So they're really, really colourful and really varied. And you can normally take them as being kind of morality tales. They're usually tales that have got a lesson buried in them. And they might be funny, they might be moving, they might be magical, they might be inspiring. They're very good, actually, for parents who are looking for stories, Buddhist stories, moral tales to tell their children. But they're also, I think, very important to Buddhist practitioners, and hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll know why. So, I think probably the best place to start is just by telling you a couple of Jataka tales. So, the first of these is the story of the hare and the moon. Now, some of you might know this. In the East, people don't talk about the man in the moon. They don't look at the moon and see what they think of as a face. They talk about the hare in the moon. They look at the moon, and what they see is the pattern of big pair of ears and a leaping hare, legs, and sort of leaping back. And this Jataka tale is a tale to tell how the hare got into the moon. Okay? And it's the story that begins with four animals, and the four animals are a jackal, an otter, a monkey, and a hare. And because this is a Jataka tale, all of these four animals are, they're treading a spiritual path. They're all practicing spiritually. But the most spiritually advanced of the four animals is the hare. And the hare is full of encouragement for his friends. He reminds them when there's a festival coming up. He exhorts them, he encourages them to meditate, he encourages them to ethical practice. And on one particular occasion, when there was a holy day coming up, he suggested that they all celebrate the festival by giving whatever food they found that day to a beggar. Okay? So they're all going to mark the day by giving their food to a beggar. And they all agree to do that, and they all go away and live, you know, they go through the festival day. But the hare's a bit disturbed because he observes that his friend the jackal will be giving meat to a beggar, and his friend the otter will be giving fish to a beggar, and his friend the monkey will be giving fruit to a beggar. But actually all he's got to give to a beggar is grass, and he doesn't think the beggars are going to be very keen on grass. So he decides what he's going to do is if he meets a beggar, he's going to give his own flesh to the beggar to eat, okay, to feed the beggar. And Shakya, the king of the gods at that time, decides that he's going to test the hare's resolve. And what he does is he goes to the hare disguised as a beggar. And so the hare sees that there's a beggar turned up, so he's going to have to follow through his resolve. And he gets a cooking fire going. And he makes the beggar comfortable sitting by the fire. And he shakes himself very carefully so that any fleas or any other insects living in his fur will all kind of escape death by being shaken off into the grass. And then he leaps into the middle of the fire. But of course, because it isn't any ordinary beggar, but it's Shakya, the king of the gods, who is sitting by the fire, he stops the hare from being burnt. And in memory of the hare's great, he's being prepared to sacrifice his life for the sake of a beggar, he paints his likeness in the moon. And that's how the hare got in the moon. Okay. That's a Jataka tale. It's a great tale, isn't it? And of course the moral is just to, to tell us all how important generosity is. Generosity of any sort. But, you know, this is the ultimate generosity, deciding that you'll give your life for the sake of someone else. Okay, so that's your first Jataka tale. Second one. This is the Jataka tale about a holy man, an ascetic. And I think that in order to understand this story, you have to understand that in the East, in the Buddhist time, and probably for hundreds of years before and for many years after, there were an awful lot of matted-haired, ragged holy men wandering around the country, begging for their food, meditating a lot, living in caves, living in forests. And this matted-haired holy man, this matted-haired holy man had all the appearances of being very devout and very advanced spiritually. But as you will see in the course of the story, there's something not quite right going on with this holy man. So this ascetic is living in the forest, and he goes on his begging rounds every day. And on a couple of occasions, he's given some lizard flesh by some of the people who are giving him food. You know, he just begs from door to door. He eats whatever he's given. He's been given some lizard flesh. He begins to develop a taste for lizard flesh. And then he notices that near the cave where he's living in the forest, there's a lizard. And actually, he notices that this lizard comes out at a certain time every day looking for food, and that he has a kind of round that he does. You can imagine what happens. This holy man, who's perhaps not as ethically good as he would hope to be, decides that this lizard would make a really good meal. And the story says that he goes out and gets himself some ghee and some spices and some curds and some salt and pepper, and he puts them in his cave. And then he gets himself a really big, heavy branch of a tree that he's picked up from the forest floor, and he puts it down next to his meditation place. and then he sits down to meditate. This is very hypocritical. He sits down to meditate, but he hasn't really got his eyes closed. He's really keeping one eye just half open to see whether this lizard is going to appear, and he's got his club ready. Anyway, so he's doing the mindfulness of breathing, sort of. But really what he's doing is, he's doing the mindfulness of where's that lizard, and I'm really hungry. And the lizard eventually appears. But the lizard is a very clever lizard. The lizard is actually the Buddha in a previous life. So, the lizard knows that something's up. He's not quite sure what's going on, but he knows that there's something not quite right going on. And he's very watchful, and he notices this holy man that he's noticed before meditating, and he just keeps half an eye on him as he's going his round looking for food. And he notices when the holy man very carefully, very silently, just stretches out his hand to get the club. And so, just as the club comes up and is thrown at the lizard, he's darted for cover. And from the safety of his hole, he chants two verses to the holy man. And I'll read you the verses, because they're really good. So this is what the lizard says. One who plays the ascetic role should exhibit self-control. You just hurled a stick at me. False ascetic thou must be. Matted hair and robe of skin serve to hide your secret sin. Fool to live for outward show, hiding what is foul below. Okay, so that's the lizard talking to the ascetic. And obviously the moral of that tale is that, I suppose, actions speak louder than words, actually. That our actions and motives are much more important than the appearances that we give to other people. Much more important to be practicing ethically than to give the appearance of being really good at meditation and, you know, good at our practice. Okay, so that gives you just a tiny taste of the Jatakas. And we'll hear one or two more as the talk goes on. So, some of you might have already got to the stage of dismissing this as kid stuff. Or as just as folk myth. And a lot of us like to, I suppose a lot of us do, actually, don't we? We like to think of ourselves as rational, or as even super rational. We like to think of Buddhism as a rational sort of religion. We like to think of it as not being tainted with all that kid stuff and all that superstitious stuff. And so there is a tendency amongst Westerners to just dismiss the Jatakas and to not take much notice of them. But I think that we shouldn't. And Sangharakshita says the same thing. He says that to appreciate the Jatakas in the right way, we've got to regard them as poetry, with a willing suspension of disbelief for whatever we can't accept on, and this is Sangharakshita's words, merely intellectual grounds. Okay, so he's saying something there about the intellect, and about the intellect not being all that's involved in our practice. I think the Jatakas are important in the same way as theatre or art or poetry is important. They're important at more than one level. They're important both at the story level and at the level of symbol. And I think that precisely because of that, they have something to teach people in all sorts of different situations, in all sorts of different societies, and people of all ages, people of all educational levels. And to that extent, the Jatakas are really important. Sangharakshita describes how in the Theravadan East in the 1950s, when he was there and saw it, pairs of monks used to tell the Jataka stories for the benefit of lay people. And he described how one would coax the other to coax the story out of them by saying, and then what happened? And which one was the Buddha? And how did it end? You know, that sort of thing. So there'd be a kind of repartee going on between one monk and the other. And they'd attract, you know, lots of lay people who'd listen to the Jataka tales and learn them, usually from childhood onwards. And then they'd talk about the moral of the tale and what the tale was teaching them. And that's a tradition that's been kept alive since the Buddha's time. And presumably, in some parts of the East, it's still going on. I also think that you can think of the Jatakas as bearing the same relation to the Dharma as Shakespearean plays relate to, the messages that they're conveying. So if we go to see Hamlet or Othello, well, we're not going to take them as literally true, but we are actually going to believe the kind of human tragedy, you know, the human sadness and anger and jealousy that's kind of bound up in those tales. We know that that's true, and we believe that, even though we know the tales aren't literally true, and what's happening on the stage isn't literally true. And in a way, that's how we've got to regard the Jataka tales. Okay, so in some tales, the message is a very simple one, like actions speak louder than words. And in many, the kind of the moral of the tale is multi-layered. It can be taken at many different levels. So, yeah, what in general do they tell us about the Dharma? Okay, there are, can't remember, three or four really important things, I think, that they tell us about the Dharma. And the first, actually, is about wisdom. I think that the Jatakas are actually quite an important wisdom teaching, because they kind of give us a perspective on our own lives and the significance of our own lives. There's a sense in which we kind of live as the stars of our own lives, don't we? You know, we're the central attraction, and all our ups are triumphs and all our downs are tragedies, you know. And we're the star of the tale. We're the one that really counts. We're the really important one. And we grasp for what we want, and we push away the things that we don't want, and we get very aggrieved if our lives go badly, if things happen to us. And we feel pretty chuffed with ourselves, actually, if things go well. You know, we think that's about us, but it's about other people if things go wrong. Given that the Jataka tales recount around 600 lives of previous lives of the Buddha, and that they are regarded as just some of the Buddha's previous lives. The Buddha Vamsa, which is these 24 tales of the Buddha's meetings with previous Buddhas, is supposed to stretch over a time scale that goes back 4 incalculable ages plus 100,000 aeons. And an incalculable age is meant to be about 10 to the power of 140. I can't work that out. It's got an awful lot of noughts on it. And an aeon is not as long as that. It's maybe 4,320 million years ago. Okay, so that's the shorter one. What we're talking about is huge timescales, vast timescales. We're talking about, life on planets well before our Earth, and hundreds of them, thousands of them. And in a sense, I think this gives us a more realistic perspective on our lives. In a way, our lives are a speck in a much bigger reality. We live a single life on quite a small planet at a particular moment when there are about 6 billion other lives on this planet. But, you know, just on this planet, there's been intelligent life for a couple of 100 million years or something. Our lives are actually quite small. They're quite, in a way, insignificant. Whatever we think about rebirth, even, you know, whether we think that rebirth is a reality or whether we think that rebirth refers to the many deaths and rebirths that we live in our own lives now, I think that the Jatakas help us to see that each life is a very brief episode in a whole tumult of births and deaths, and that we aren't really the centre of the universe, that we're part of something much, much bigger than us. And waking up to that reality is what is going to make us free. So that's the sense in which I think the Jatakas are wisdom tales, just by giving us that sense of perspective. Nevertheless, what we do with that brief episode of life matters a lot, because the Jatakas also demonstrate wonderfully, really, that actions definitely have consequences. They teach us that if we work from negative mental states and from selfishness, then we're likely to bring suffering on ourselves. and that if we work from predominantly love for others, then we're likely to move towards greater happiness for ourselves and greater freedom. Or put another way, ethical behaviour develops the qualities that will lead to enlightenment. And actually, you know, what we see is that the Buddha lives many, many, many hundreds and thousands of lives, and eventually he gets enlightened. So, here's another example. This is the tale of a tigress. And actually, this tale comes with a health warning. And the health warning is not to take it too literally. Okay. So once there was a great king, and this great king was called Maharatha, and he had three fine sons. And the three fine sons were all called Maha something. There was Mahapranada, Mahadeva, and Mahasattva. And these three princes were all people who were following a spiritual path. And they didn't go hunting in the forest, but they did go walking in the forest. And one day, when they were walking in the forest, the three princes came upon a tigress who had seven cubs. But the tigress was in a bad way. So far from being afraid of this tigress, they realized that this tigress was incredibly, incredibly weak. She was so weak that she couldn't feed her seven cubs. And it looked pretty bad for both her and the cubs, actually. Because a tigress that doesn't even bat an eyelid, seeing three pretty good meals going by, three human meals going by, is probably in a bad way. So, the three brothers were very disturbed about this, and they talked about what they could do to help the tigress. And, they wondered about going to get some food, and they talked about this and they talked about that. But actually, they were a long way from the palace. They were a long way from being able to find any food for her. And two of the brothers kind of just walked on, but one of the brothers said, "Oh, well, just leave me for a bit, and you two go on, and I'm going to have a think and see whether I can think of anything to do for this tigress." And the one who stayed was called Mahasattva. And Mahasattva was, well, he was just moved with great compassion for the tigress and for her cubs, who looked likely never to grow up. So when his brothers were gone, Mahasattva laid himself down in front of the tigress, just waiting to be killed, really. But the tigress was actually so weak, she didn't even make a move. So what Mahasattva then did is to get a sharp bamboo and to slit his own throat in front of the tigress. And the pool of blood in front of the tigress, she was just about strong enough to lap up. And the blood kind of gave her strength, and as she gathered strength, and she gathered enough strength to be able to eat some meat, and then to help her cubs to eat the meat in front of her. So Mahasattva literally sacrificed himself for the sake of a family of tigers. Okay. That's why I say, don't take it too literally. The moral of the story isn't that we should go around slitting our throats for wild animals, okay? Nor that a family of tigers is worth more than the life of a human. Really, the whole point of the story is about the centrality of compassion in the spiritual path. The centrality of compassion and selflessness, really. Both the hare in the earlier story and the prince in this story were willing to do anything up to the point of sacrificing their lives for the sake of other beings. And, well, the hare is rewarded immediately in a sense because he has his image painted in the moon, but the prince isn't. The prince is allowed to die, and he dies. But the point is that both are the future Buddha. The point is that both eventually reap the results of their compassionate action, because both eventually become the man who became the Buddha Gautama. Both eventually attained enlightenment. So the moral actually is clear. If you develop compassion and practice self-sacrifice in big ways or small ways, eventually you will make your way to enlightenment. Okay, and that's a pretty good moral, isn't it? So in other words, the tales demonstrate the message of the Bodhisattva ideal in a way that a whole series of lectures couldn't really. And just for the benefit of those people who haven't come across the Bodhisattva ideal, Yeah, bodhisattva is a word with two meanings. There are bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya that you have probably come across, because we have pictures of them and rupas of them around the Buddha Center. They're the beings who are the archetypal bodhisattvas, whose images we use to inspire us with their qualities like wisdom and compassion. But then the other meaning of the word bodhisattva is a flesh and blood being, you know, a human being, or could be an animal, actually, because it is in a lot of the Jataka tales, who live their lives with a great aim of helping all beings to attain enlightenment. And there's a sense in which the Jataka tales are, well, they're the tales of 600 or so bodhisattva lives, in each of which the bodhisattva who eventually becomes the Buddha is kind of working his way slowly towards enlightenment. So what the bodhisattva is doing in each life is he's working to perfect his ethical conduct. And actually, one of the sort of ethical precepts that we see demonstrated again and again and again and again in the Jataka tales is the precept of generosity. And the gifts are not always big gifts. Some of them are huge gifts, like, you know, the gift of life, as in the two stories that we've heard. But actually, there's a story about a Brahmin who gives away his sandals. A pair of sandals isn't that big. He was a Brahmin who had particularly delicate feet, so it was a bit of a bigger deal for him than for someone who had tough feet, but that's not a big deal. There was the story of a great emperor who gave whatever was needed to anyone in his empire. And actually, that might sound like a big deal, but for an emperor who's got a lot of power and a lot of wealth, perhaps that wasn't such a big deal either. There are a couple of other very big deals. King Sivi, there's a story about King Sivi, who was a king who plucked out both of his eyes with his bare hands and gave them to a blind old man. And that seems a particularly daft thing to me anyway, because you can see the moral. The moral is that he's trying to give sight to someone and he doesn't need the eyes. He's hoping that the other person will be able to make use of them. Hope he could. Maybe it was a miracle. And then there's the story of Prince Vasantara. And Prince Vasantara is an interesting one, because Prince Vasantara was a prince in a kingdom. And he loved his kingdom. He had a lovely family. He had lovely children. Had a lot of wealth. He was about to inherit the kingdom. But he decided to make a practice of generosity. And he decided that he would give whatever was asked of him. And actually, he came a cropper, because the people of a rival kingdom asked him to give them the auspicious and powerful royal elephant. Because he was making a practice of generosity, he vowed that he would, then he gave them the royal elephant, which made him very unpopular in his own kingdom, so he was banished. So he then had to go and live, presumably in a different kingdom, perhaps in the rival kingdom. He took his wife and children with him. But there came a time when someone asked him for his wife, and he gave away his wife. And then someone asked him for his children, and he gave away his children. Because once he'd made a vow that he would give away whatever he was asked for, then he decided he would do it. And I think this one comes with the same health warning as the story of the tigress. Don't take it too literally. I think that, the ethics of giving away people are something that we should just not visit. You know, don't go there. We don't give away people. People are worth far too much. And I suppose we also have to remember that these stories come from a culture in which, actually, wives and children were regarded as the property of people, which is something that we probably also wouldn't agree with. So don't go into the whys and wheres for. Just take the moral away from it. Okay, so these are all very, very positive examples of how the bodhisattva worked through countless lifetimes towards the achieving of enlightenment. But there are also some Jataka tales that demonstrate the negative workings of karma. Those of you who have read the life of the Buddha might have come across stories about the Buddha's cousin. The Buddha had a cousin called Devadatta. And you might know, those of you who've read about the Buddha, that Devadatta was very jealous of the Buddha. And there was actually a point at which Devadatta plotted to have the Buddha killed. And the Jataka tales actually present a kind of karmic history of Devadatta. There are various Jataka tales in which Devadatta is shown as living lives that kind of developed and reinforced the negative tendencies that led to, that just kind of stoked up his jealousy. And when this character, who eventually became Devadatta, experiences the success of others in previous lives, he feels jealousy, and then rather than kind of staying in the gap and just noticing that, just kind of working with it, he responds at different times in different tales by either spreading vicious rumours, or sometimes he responds with violence, and actually there are times when he responds with murder. So there are previous lives, so the Jatakas tell us, when Devadatta has actually murdered the Bodhisattva who eventually became the Buddha. So that's quite a good object lesson in how indulging negative emotions actually sets us on a kind of downward spiral. Okay, so that's Devadatta, but there are actually a dozen or so other Jataka tales in which the Buddha himself is presented in a less than positive light. Okay, those are interesting ones. The Bodhisattva's faults in those Jataka tales range from doubting a previous Buddha, doubting that spiritual progress is possible, verbally putting down a previous Buddha, yes, criticising him, saying what a load of rubbish. And there's even one story in which the Bodhisattva resorts to murder. So there are tales, there are times in previous lives in which the Bodhisattva has been less than perfect and less than generous. And actually these negative tales are intended to explain various mishaps, small mishaps that happened to the Buddha during the life in which he became enlightened. And there's quite a nice one here that I'll tell you. This is the story of an ascetic, a holy man, so another holy man. And this holy man had been practicing very, very hard, been doing a lot of meditation. And he'd been practicing so hard that he actually developed siddhis, he developed supernatural powers. And one of these powers that he developed was the ability to fly. And so this ascetic, every now and again, flies on his begging rounds, presumably so he can get back quicker to meditate. So he goes out, begs some food, eats it, and then flies back to the forest to meditate. But one day, he flies past the second floor window of the palace. And he just glances into the palace. And what he sees through this window is the very young and beautiful queen who is stretched out, not quite naked, on the bed, with just a beautiful sort of flimsy veil thrown over part of her. And he's so overcome with lust that he loses concentration and falls to the ground with a thud. I think the moral of that one is that desire leads to lack of mindfulness and therefore to suffering. And the Buddha actually tells that story as encouragement to one of his followers who has been doing really well until he sees a really beautiful young woman on his begging round who is dressed in gay apparel, it says. And he becomes so obsessed with her that he's thinking about giving up the spiritual life to go and be with her. And this story is intended to just encourage him. Okay, so I think that these negative Jatakas serve a very useful purpose for people like us. I think they encourage us so that we can work towards enlightenment in spite of past skillfulness. Just as the Buddha did, So the Buddha had many lives in which he was living very skillfully, but every now and again he didn't do so well. Okay, so we can do the same. We can take hope because the Jatakas are tales of imperfection as well as of continuing improvement. And again, whether or not we believe in rebirth, the point of these tales is that by living for the sake of others, we just bring ourselves closer and closer to enlightenment, just as every life recounted in the Jataka tales brings the Buddha closer to enlightenment. It also shows, I think, that our purpose is a grand one, and that we shouldn't really expect immediate results. Like the Bodhisattvas in these tales, we've got to make the most of the conditions that we're in. And sometimes conditions will be better than others. In a way, we can think of each of the lives as a phase in our current lives. The circumstances that we're in from one moment to the next, or from one year to the next. And in a sense, in every moment, whatever the circumstances, there is an opportunity to work for others rather than ourselves. I think also it helps us to not disparage other people, to not look down on other people who appear not to be practicing very well. It may be that the hungry ghost that you look down on is working out some vestiges of karma from a previous existence, and that, you know, in another lifetime, or maybe even like Milarepa in this lifetime, they're actually going to make it to enlightenment. Okay, I think the final message of the Jataka tales is one of interconnectedness. There's a kind of refrain at the end of every single Jataka tale, and it follows a set formula. The tales are kind of framed as if they're being told by the Buddha. So they're being told by the Buddha to his disciples about one of his previous lives. So he starts off the tale by kind of telling them, you know, setting the scene for this tale, and then he goes into the story. And then at the end of the tale, he identifies the characters. And he says, in this tale, so-and-so was Ananda, one of the Buddha's disciples. In this tale, so-and-so was Kasyapa. So-and-so was King Ajatasattu, and so on. And then finally, he reveals which character he was in the Jataka tale. And actually, if you read enough of these tales, if you read enough of the end bit, the kind of formulaic bit at the end of those tales, what you begin to get is an impression of a whole big group of characters who are travelling together from rebirth to rebirth. And they're kind of the same character is popping up, you know, now as a lizard, and then as a monkey, and then as a disciple, and then as an enemy, and then as a king, and then as a beggar. You see what I mean? They're kind of moving round from one rebirth to another, but they're all kind of bumping into each other from one life in one life after another. And they're all kind of making progress as they go, sometimes slipping back and sometimes making progress. But the general trend is upward. The general trend is towards enlightenment. And then, of course, in the Buddha's lifetime, well, the Buddha is the first to break through to enlightenment, but actually, those whole band of people who've been living these previous lives with him also become enlightened, almost all of them, during the Buddha's lifetime. And, I just find that incredibly encouraging, because I can transfer it to the Sheffield Buddha Centre. And, you know, I can look at us as a band of people who, and maybe in previous lives, but maybe this is the first time, are getting together. And I like to think of us kind of travelling the rounds of rebirth together, coming across each other in life after life, and encouraging each other and supporting each other, and maybe slipping back a bit, but always, on the whole, making progress towards an eventual breakthrough, so that eventually, at some point in a future life, and maybe even in this life, we all make it through together. You know, the bodhicitta arises. We make it to enlightenment. And, if we take that lesson from the Jataka tales, then maybe it's just a question of time. And maybe someone here will be the first to achieve enlightenment, and then all the rest of us will follow.